Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. I don't know how many women in this room had to get their husband's permission to apply for a credit card, but if you are of a certain age, it's possible that you did. And if you've been watching Mad Men, you'll certainly have been thinking, recognizing how circumscribed women's lives were in the late 50s and early 60s. And in the years since 1960, we've witnessed such stunning changes in women's lives and also in the expectations of what women's lives could be. Gail Collins tells the story of cataclysmic change within 5 years of crucial progress in the same tone, wonderful tone, for which this New York Times columnist is known. And if you're here tonight, you're probably already a Gail Collins fan, one of the thousands, millions perhaps, who scrawl, read this on Gail's columns and then leaves them in the middle of the breakfast table. I love her voice and her irreverent wit, and I'm sure many of you as well do. Gail Collins joined the New York Times in 1995 as a member of the editorial board and later as an op-ed columnist. In 2001, she became the first woman ever appointed editor of the Times editorial page. She stepped down in 2007 to take a leave to work on this book to finish When Everything Changed and returned to the Times as a columnist in 2007. Before joining the Times, she was a columnist at Newsday and the New York Daily News and a reporter for United Press International. At Newsday, she had a colleague, Nick Goldberg, who will be her interviewer tonight. So they have a lot to share and a lot to talk about. It's sort of the New York editorial meets Los Angeles editorial. Last month, Nick was appointed editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial pages, and his responsibilities include oversight of the Times editorial board, as well as op-ed, Sunday opinion, and letters. And he joined the Times in 2006 as op-ed editor and was most recently before this the editorial page's deputy editor. So he and Gail will talk about both her book and also issues pertinent to journalism today. Please welcome Gail Collins and Nick Goldberg. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Good. Thank you for coming. I'm Nick Goldberg. I guess I should start by saying that that Gail and I are old friends. We've known each other since long before she went to the New York Times and long before I came to the LA Times. And we actually, in addition to working together for many years, we actually shared an experience that is generally only shared by newlyweds. And I haven't mentioned this to Gail, and I'm curious if she has any idea what it is I'm referring to.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Go ahead, deny it. No, the experience is that we went to Niagara Falls together.
True. Oh my God. Yes.
We had the good fortune to be covering the Democratic State Convention in Buffalo, New York. And we got up, I believe, at about 5 a.m. in the morning. All our colleagues wanted to sleep later, and we got on a boat, and we went to the bottom of Niagara Falls together, and it was absolutely fabulous and life-changing and a lot better than anything else that happened that weekend.
And except... You've forgotten that I said to Nick, we cannot possibly, nobody in their right mind can go to Buffalo without going to Niagara Falls, because otherwise you'll just have been in Buffalo for the whole weekend. And I was right, right? I mean, it was a life-changing experience.
I'm one of the few people I know who's ever been to Niagara Falls. Anyway, we should get started because I want to do a lot of stuff here tonight. I want to talk partly about Gail's new book. I want to talk partly about Gail's job and her life at the New York Times. And I want to talk partly, but very briefly, because it's an unutterably depressing subject to me, about the future of the newspaper business. So we'll keep that. We're gonna keep that limited. We're gonna keep it as short
as the
future of the newspaper
business. I'd rather talk
about the
healthcare plan.
So let's start with your book a little bit. You open it with a long description, which Louise alluded to, of what life was like for women in 1960. The book is called When Everything Changed. It was here, but now I don't see it. I think it's called When Everything Changed, and it's about the transformation in the lives of women from 1960 to the present. It's a companion to a previous book that you wrote about everything that happened from the beginning of the world until 1960.
From 1640 until
then. From 1640.
It was going to be one book. I mean, my plan was to write one book about what happened to women in America. But it's sort of like when you take a course in American history, you find that it's the end of the year and you're only at World War II, and that sort of happened to me. It was either make it a 700-page book or just stop, and so that's why this book came along, too.
So anyway, it opens with some anecdotes and stories and statistics to tell you about what life was like for... Thank you. This is my copy. You guys can buy your own in the lobby. what life was like. As Louise said, you know, a woman couldn't get a lease on an apartment. I wrote some of these things down, so let me look at them. A woman couldn't get a lease on an apartment unless it was co-signed by her husband. It was perfectly and completely legal to discriminate on the basis of sex. Husbands had control in most places or many places of women's property and earnings. Women were barred from serving on juries in some state. They were routinely paid less. Women were banned from United Airlines executive flights from New York to Chicago. And when women did work, which was not that common unless you were a poor woman or a black woman or an otherwise non-white woman, they tended to be, you know, teachers, nurses, secretaries, receptionists, bookkeepers, librarians, stewardesses. But Gail opens the book with one of a number of stories that are sprinkled through the book about pants. Pants are a recurring theme through the book. So I was wondering if you could start and tell us the story of this Lois Rabinowitz who opens the book.
Rabinowitz.
And then tell us why pants, any other stories you can think of, and why pants became such an important, or clothes
traveling
in general.
Pants, all that,
traveling
yeah.
pants.
Lois Rabinowitz, this is in the summer of 1960, the tragic day for Lois Rabinowitz, who was a secretary in Manhattan, and she was sent by her boss to pay a parking ticket and became the big story of the day in the city because she was evicted from traffic court for attempting to pay a ticket while wearing slacks. And the magistrate just went nuts and talked about how she was defaming the dignity of the traffic court. And because it was her husband's ticket, she couldn't just leave. So she called her boss's ticket. So she called her husband, Irwin, who was a chauffeur, and they'd only been married for 2 weeks at this point. So Irwin came running down, and he paid the ticket, but then the magistrate gave Irwin a huge speech about how he had to crack down right away, or this was going to keep going on, and why couldn't women be on a pedestal, and so on and so forth. And I really liked them. From the first book that I did, I learned then that often, like, the clothes that women wear are sort of a definition of what they're supposed to be doing. And the thing about wearing a skirt back then was pantyhose hadn't been invented yet. So if you had a skirt on, you had nylons on, which, of course, could get runs, but then you also had to keep the nylons up, so you probably wore a girdle. And I've read it. All these poor women said, I was 14 years old and I weighed 97 pounds, but when I went to school in the morning, I had to put on a girdle to keep up my nylons. And Barbie had a girdle. The individual least in need of a foundation in the entire world had a girdle. I mean, it was just everybody. And it really did define the idea that women didn't move around much. Girls didn't play sports then. You know, none of the schools had girls' sports to speak of. Women didn't travel. The only way you could travel, have a career that caused you to travel, was if you became a stewardess. And it just sort of squished into everything. And it was so important to women when you started talking to them again about what happened then. Everybody seemed to have a story about how they weren't allowed to wear slacks. They got sent home from school because they wore slacks. And I remember that when I was in college, we were not allowed to leave the dorm wearing slacks unless we were going bowling. Much bowling was done.
Reasonable.
I mean,
Some rules are good rules.
Really, you'd have thought there was nothing but bowling lanes up and down Milwaukee the way we were signing out for it. But, and then gradually, as you could just sort of see, as things change, one of the things that changes is that suddenly women get to sort of decide for themselves what they're going to wear, and slacks come in. It's a very big deal.
It was a big deal. I mean, one of the reasons you should be being interviewed by a woman, as I started to mention out there, is because I don't really understand the relationship between the girdle and the pantyhose. And we're not going to do it here, but you could do a diagram or something.
This is interesting later. Because I have to say that, you know, this is the difference between interviewers. Sometimes when guys have interviewed me over the last several weeks, they had an intimate knowledge of the girdles versus the, you know, the various other kinds of accoutrements you could have to hold up nylons.
Some people do their homework before they come out to an interview.
What can I say, Nick?
And you quote, yeah, in fact, you had a quote in there that you had Felix Frankfurter saying that I can't stand women in pants, and you had Richard Nixon asking Helen Thomas, I think.
So you're wearing pants, Helen? Is that, you know, do you find that comfortable? It just bothers me. I don't know.
One of the nice things about the book is that it's told in these sort of anecdotes and stories about, and it follows certain women through the years. Some of them are famous, some of them are utterly unknown. One of the women is Betty Friedan, mm-hmm. who is famous. And you tell a story that I didn't know about how she was assigned by some women's magazine to go out and interview housewives. And this is what sort of created the feminine mystique. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, she actually was going back to her... She was an unhappy housewife herself. She was a really unhappy housewife, as a matter of fact. She was a writer, but she was, you know, living in the suburbs in New York, and she's got this thing about her reunion at Smith, and it just became obsessed with this reunion, and she was going to do a questionnaire to show the argument was that women should go to college, that would make you a better wife, that the fact that all the women got married at that time, practically, when they were just leaving college, if you didn't get engaged in your senior year, you were really kind of a loser at that point in time. But, you know, she was going to argue for McCall's, I think it was, against the idea that it was a waste of time for girls to go to college just because they were going to get married and never go and work. So she put together this monster questionnaire, and she sent it out to all of her fellow alumni, and then got back what she said were just these extraordinary yelps of pain and misery from these women who were very unhappy, and then went up to Smith and found that the Smith kids themselves were totally disinterested in careers and just wanted to get married. And all this stuff sort of squished together and turned into this book, which is a remarkable diatribe. You know, the thing that I think made it so powerful was that it was a polemic. I mean, and she was just going at it hammer and tong, and she's a very accessible writer. Her statement was actually, if you read it now, very moderate. All she wanted was for people to have jobs. She didn't, you know, it wasn't like, let's overthrow the male patriarchy and establish a dictatorship of the Amazonians or something. It was just, let's have jobs. It was very tiny, but yet, you know, it was huge. And the women who read it just were taken by it. This was the first generation in which people had enough money that they could send their daughters to college just sort of on general principles to be upwardly mobile because they would marry a guy who went to college and stuff. So that was the big deal. And they went to college. They took the same courses the guys took. They often got better grades than the guys did. But there was always this expectation. They'd get married then and return home and raise families. And some of them just turned out to not like it at all. And they were very miserable.
The quote that stayed with me was, what did she say? One woman said to her, "I'm a server of food and a putter on of pants."
Yes.
And I thought that was so depressing.
A lot of women liked it. A lot of women were extremely happy during that period of time. But if you weren't happy, you tended to be really, really, really unhappy.
So here's the second one. This is the last anecdote like this I'm going to ask you to tell. But another woman who you profile in here is Helen Gurley Brown, mm-hmm. who had a different relation to the relationship to the women's movement. Why don't you tell us about
Helen Gurley Brown was, you know, she was a secretary herself, and she worked her way up in the business. She was very poor, came from a very poor family, and she figured out ways to make money and to save money, and she supported herself. She had a very nice car that she paid for herself. Her husband-to-be, who was a producer, the first time he discovered that she had actually paid for her own car, was just enamored with the idea. This was a woman who was not going to probably ask for alimony sometime in the future. But she, and she were, I think she read a story, there was one, somebody wrote a story about the question of whether or not, you know, biology was destiny and whether or not there was any imperative for all women to get pregnant and so on and so forth. And basically she said yes, that any woman who didn't get married and have children was going to become neurotic and terrible, because that was, unlike men who just could waste their seed anywhere, women's point was to have babies. And she didn't agree with it, and she mentioned it to her husband, who said, well, this could be the book you write. And she wrote a book about how you could be really happy being single. And this was a whole new thought that had not been thought at that time before. The idea, Playboy kept saying how much fun men had if they were single, and they could have neat apartments, they'd have jazz on, you know.
Great martinis.
And all these women would come and have sex with them. And basically she said,
My experience as a single man.
I remember that about you in Albany. Yeah, that's what they said about it. But, you know, this was...
Things were very cool in Albany.
We were threatening back there to talk about Albany all night because we were there together, but I know this would probably not really... I don't see any hands out there. There's an Albany guy there. Okay. I'm sorry. Where were we? I'm totally...
Sex and the single woman.
Sex and the single woman. This is a great new thought that women would have all this stuff, too. The women could have a really nice apartment. They could have really, you know, good stuff. They could have fun. They could have good careers. And they could have lots of sex and not be married. And that it would be more boring to be married. And that their married sisters were sitting there doing the laundry while they were playing jazz and having martinis.
Believe it took till 1965 to figure this out.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And it was a big thing. Well, you know, I mean, Sex and the Single Girl was like this huge, huge phenomenon at the time.
Here was something that interested me as I read the book. You say that when women were first permitted to vote in the United States, many, you know, early suffragists believed that they were going to vote as a group and that they would vote for things like sort of a shared agenda. They would vote for infants' rights and help for pregnant women and better schools and things that affected women's life. But then in the end, when women really started to vote in 1960, Gail points out, is the first time that more women actually voted than men, that when they voted, it turned out that just like men, they voted on the basis of class, race, ethnic loyalties, and all the same old silly things that the rest of us vote on. What do you make of that? I mean,
this is the problem with the whole women's movement thing. It's very hard to mobilize a women's movement as opposed to, say, civil rights movement for African Americans or Hispanic rights or even disabled rights. It's hard because women are so intertwined with men, you know, and women's interests are often more the interests of their male, their husbands, their brothers, their sons, than they are of other women when they see their lives. So it's really, really, really hard for women to get together and push all by themselves. And what usually happened in American history is that they kind of piggyback on some other progressive movement. Women's rights started with abolition. And then the progressive movement in the early part of the 20th century, and then the civil rights movement again. So you sort of had to have that second thing there.
Although one of the things you point out that's also extremely interesting in the book is that although people associate the women's movement with the civil rights movement, there was a lot of conflict between the two. There were a lot of times where a decision had to be made, you know, could the civil rights movement also include women, or did women have to be left behind because that would just make it too politically unpassable?
Well, that was an issue for black women. It was not, I mean, there were white women who were in the civil rights movement often once things became, you know, more, the black nationalism sort of moved in, tended to move into the women's rights movement and the anti-war movement. For black women, all through the civil rights movement, there was that real tension, particularly for older women who had been organizing for 100 billion years and who really had been leaders in their communities. There was a lot of resistance on the part of men, black men, to have them in leadership. And the sort of the famous example is Rosa Parks, when she came back from being arrested. there was this huge rally to meet her, and when she walked in, the minister said, "You've done enough. You can just sit here now, and we'll take over." And she did. She said later, if it had been a little bit later, she would have known better. But and when the Great March in Washington happened, Rosa Parks marched with the wives. And not a single woman spoke at the March on Washington, and not a single woman went to meet with the president when the leaders met. It was, and even the women in the movement, the black women who had been really into the idea that they wanted to empower men, that that was really important, like Dorothy Height, once you got to this sudden moment when, you know, this is the big day, and the women got to sit on the stage as long as they didn't talk, they were all horrified, and that but you know, nobody wanted to really separate from the community to throw their lot with women as opposed to the community at that point in time. And within the women's rights movement, the sort of reform part where people are talking about getting better jobs and more pay and things like that was much more popular with black women than the one that was going to reform men and fix men and, you know, make men better and change marriage and change the world and sort of reform society completely to make it more woman-friendly. So there was all that stuff going on at the time.
You also talk about how when the when African-Americans were first getting the right to vote, there was an effort to also allow women the right to vote, but ultimately that got left on the floor because it was decided that was politically impossible to do, and it took, I don't know how many more decades before women got their vote. But then again, with the Civil Rights Act of 1965, there was this big battle over whether women should or shouldn't be included among the groups mm-hmm. who could not be discriminated against.
And it was offered as a joke first, the idea that women would be included in the Civil Rights Act, that you would also prohibit job discrimination against women as well as the other protected classes, particularly African Americans. It was a Southerner named Howard Smith who was head of the Rules Committee. He was like 90 million years old. He hated civil rights. When the Voting Rights Act went through, it had to go through rules. He couldn't stop it, so he just vanished for several weeks. He claimed his barn had burned down and he had to go home. Sam Rayburn said, "I knew Howard wanted to stop this bill, but I didn't know he'd resort to arson at the time to do it." But so he got this thing, and he got up and offered an amendment to include women. But the amazing Martha Griffiths from Michigan was there, and she had figured this out, that this was going to happen. And she had determined that if she took her people, her liberals, and combined them with the conservatives who were going to vote with Smith, she could actually do this thing. They passed it in the House, and it went to the Senate, where the amazing Margaret Chase Smith just grabbed it and ran right through the goalpost with it. And then it became law. And women had never thought that was going to happen. It did not occur to anybody that they were going to get something that big. Nobody had that. They were thinking maybe possibly a study commission someday or something. But once they had it, once the law was passed, and it became clear that nobody intended to enforce it, then everybody really did get their backs up. And that's when now was directly created as a response to the fact that nobody was going to enforce the Civil Rights Act when it came to women. And the first people into the office, the EEOC, when it was established to enforce the Civil Rights Act, the first people through the door while the typists were still taking their stuff out of their boxes were the stewardesses. And the poor secretaries had been expecting, like, black steel workers would be the first ones, and in come all these stewardesses. And then the stewardesses told them that they had these rules that said you couldn't be married, and then if you got married, you were fired, you know, and you were checked out, you know, the weight things and the height things and the white gloves things. And the secretaries were horrified and started typing away, you know, stewardesses were heroines of this movement, and they really never get any credit for it at all, I think.
All right, let's change gears a little bit here and talk about you. The connection between you and your book is that you also broke a barrier. You became the first woman to edit the editorial pages of the New York Times. I've been up to the editorial pages of the New York Times. They're kind of club in the old building. New York Times now moved into this fancy new building that they'll no doubt have to sell any minute.
We already did, excuse me.
um, But the old building, it was, you know, it was paneled walls and clubby.
It was cool,
and stodgy. It was very cool. It had lots of pictures of old, important-looking white men shaking hands with other old, important-looking white men. And I wondered what was it like to be a woman and come into that job for the first time in 125 years or whatever it was.
It was actually very pleasant. When it was not something I was planning on doing, frankly. I mean, I'd never thought about being an editor. And Hal Raines, who was the outgoing editor, thought this would be neat. I mean, you know, I think basically the whole idea of having a woman would be neat. And he said...
Neat, like in the way that other guy thought it would be a joke to put in the...
No.
Actually,
Al,
neat.
Al really thought it would be neat. And he said, you know, you write about the history of women. You could be a paragraph here, you know. And I thought, well, maybe a subordinate clause or something. But, you know, and when I got the job, I walked around the building. I just tell everybody was really happy. It wasn't about me, but they were really happy about the idea of having a woman have this job. There was, like, no pushback at all. And there is, as Nick said, there's still a big room, but the old room was this Glorioski paneled room with pictures of old white men along the sides of the walls. And the two that, when I sat at one end of the table, I looked at were Charles Miller and Henry Raymond. And Charles Miller and Henry Raymond had written the defining New York Times editorials explaining why women should not be given the right to vote. And my favorite one of them was one that was something like, some say that all human beings have the right to vote. This is obviously not true. Small children do not have the right to vote. Therefore, women. Yeah. And so whenever I came in, I used to tell people I like to come in early every once in a while and kind of say, hi, guys. I got your job.
And there, I mean, even to this day, there haven't been many women columnists in my own. There's Maureen Dowd with you. There was a woman for many years named Flora Lewis, who I simply could not read. Simply could never get past.
You could
the
never
first
read
paragraph.
Any of the columnists back then. They were a whole different era of columns.
That's
than
true, and I was seven.
That's true.
But
it's true. You know, it's weird about women and opinions. We would have every year when I was the editor our women discussion, in which we would discuss. The poor letters to the editor guy and the op-ed guy would have to come in with their percentages of how many women, you know, they had on the page. And it was always pathetic. And then they would come in with their... Basically, although there's never any excuse for this stuff, you can always do more, the women number of women who write letters to the editor is way, 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 like about 30%, 35%. Of all the letters we got were from women. The number of unsolicited op-eds that we got from women were about there, too. And we'd had many meetings about it. One of the meetings, somebody, I think it was Jill, maybe, Abramson, said, well, you know, I think maybe it's that women are not comfortable, because we prize these days, we prize speed so much. You know, if something happens, you want an op-ed the next day. So I think women might not be as comfortable in taking strong stances on things about which they only have a superficial knowledge.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. Men are blowhards.
Well, my thought was, this is a definition of an op-ed columnist, actually.
Sure. I mean, well, or of an op-ed. I think of an op-ed, you know, submission sender. I mean, this is someone who thinks that the entire world wants to know what they think about some issue that in many cases they don't know much about. It's absolutely true. Yeah, they're blowhards, so women are perhaps more reticent about that.
So, well, maybe, but that seems to be at least the reason that 10 years ago there weren't more women. I'm not even sure now, because the whole column thing has sort of squished into the blogging thing and the other things, what the percentages are.
Now, I want to ask you about your colleagues on the op-ed page. I mean, everyone who reads the New York Times reads the op-ed page, and you know all these people as if they were our friends. And I'm right. Curious whether you guys are friends, whether you know each other, what I wanted to ask is, like, do you come into the office and is Tom Friedman sitting there like always on the phone, you know, yakking with the, you know, with Henry Kissinger or with the Pope or something? And you got to walk by that, and you know, Maureen Dowd's talking to David Geffen, and I mean, what's
I have to tell you one Tom Friedman story, because I have told this when Tom's around at his various book parties. Well, I think it was my last book. I was talking with Tom, you know, and I was, you know, about to go out and take the poor puppy out and walk, you know, sell it. And I said, you know, Tom, you've done this so often. Do you have any, you know, hints for me about, you know, book tours? And he said, crowd control is so important.
It's true. That was a big issue here tonight.
Yeah. Oh, it's hell.
There's an invisible plexiglass thing here so that your groupies don't come at you.
Yeah, well, you know, half of them are in Washington. Half the columnists are in Washington. Paul Krugman is in Princeton, and, you know, he's sort of between the two. And then there's the rest of us are in New York. So there's only a few of us, you know, four of us in New York. And Nick Kristof and I are the only ones who tend to come in regularly. And Nick is
often, always in Africa.
He's always in some place really bad, you know, and horrible. You know, he does this thing every
year. You've already told us that you've spent time in Albany, Buffalo, and Milwaukee. Where exactly has Nick Kristof been that's worse than that? I defy you.
I'm silenced completely. You're totally right. God, you know. He does a thing called the Win a Trip with Nick contest every year in which, you know, college students enter, and if they win, they get to go off for 2 weeks with Nick.
No, 2 weeks is second prize.
No.
First prize is 1 week.
No, yeah, that's the thing. Yeah.
Sorry,
one trip, two trips is second prize.
Sorry, I stepped on your joke.
He goes to terrible places, and it's just so I used to get bills when I was the editor, you know, like, hotel, 25 cents. You know.
No,
I knew you were going to do
no
that.
No one's heard anything I said. Sorry. Go on. This is something I've always wondered about all these guys, but do you have a beat? I mean, is there something that's within your territory? Could you write about, I mean, if you wrote about monetary policy, would Paul Krugman get all bent out of shape and stuff?
He'd be really perplexed, but no. As would the world, I think. No, but the only thing is that, you know, the editors put us on the days they put us on, basically, in order to. And the worst thing that I ever had to do when I was editor was to do the columnist schedule. It is just beyond hell. It's just, I mean, you just die. It's so horrible. But one of the things they have to do is try to. I think, like, for instance, they probably would never put me and Maureen on the same days. You just want to put people who are kind of balanced. And I have, like, Nick. I like being up with Nick because we very seldom write about the same things. But, I mean, I could, in theory, I could write about monetary policy. I could write about foreign affairs. I would fear for the consequences, but, you know, I would, you know, you can do it.
Do you have? I was once told that op-ed columnists at the New York Times don't get edited. Is that true?
It sort of is. We go right to the copy editor, and he looks for spelling and fact checks and stuff. But the rule always was, in theory, that if there was something that the editor found so horrible and offensive that they really wanted to change, that the only thing you had the power to do was just to pull the entire column. You didn't have the power to, you know, force. I mean, in the real world, if you call up a columnist.
I mean, you, the editor,
yeah,
only could
the
pull
editor,
it. They
yeah.
couldn't, they
I could
couldn't
pull
force
it, but
the
I couldn't,
columnist.
I couldn't say, you know, Paul.
You're talking about
fix
when you
that.
Were an editor,
yeah.
not as a columnist.
No.
Yeah.
Nobody can do that. But I mean, really, if Andy calls me and says, I hate your third paragraph, it's disgusting and appalling, I'm not going to sit there and say, I have a right to have that disgusting and appalling third paragraph. Screw you. You change it. But in theory, that's the
rule. What's
the
theory behind no editing?
You know, I think it's that, and this is actually not, I don't know how it is at the LA Times, but I presume it's the same. You don't actually want to take responsibility. It's not the same there? Whoops. Well, there you are. See, the theory is that you don't want to take responsibility for us. I mean, we...
I can understand why they feel that way at the New York Times.
And you don't, huh? You just
no,
you sit
no,
there and rewrite these guys all the time? I had no idea.
I just have to rewrite it in their opinions. No, we do. We do. We don't rewrite them, but we edit them the way we edit anything
oh,
else.
Yeah. But
I mean, we don't. I'm sorry. We don't edit it with the same heavy hand that we might use on an outside contributor. We do understand they're columnists. They're our people. They're writing regularly. We have to have a certain degree of trust in them. But there's no. They are read by line editors, and they talk about what they're going to be writing with their assigning editors.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not as much freedom.
When we
as you
write,
know.
It's a big surprise to the editors every time.
Whoa!
How
exciting
look at
for
that.
Them.
Yeah. Who knew?
You know, if I had to sum up your column, I don't know why I'm doing this. This is a mistake. But if I had to sum up your column, I'd say that, you know, you're basically bringing sort of rational, straight-talking, common sense, and some measure of outrage to the stupidity and hypocrisy and corruption of public officials. I mean, that's not all you write about, but that's something you've written about an awful lot ever since I've known you, especially when we were in Albany, and that it was kind of low-hanging fruit. but as you would, and you could come to Sacramento and you'd find the same thing. But can you think of either the dumbest politicians you've covered, or the most outrageous political scandal or anecdotes? I'm putting you on the spot.
You really are. Actually, I gotta tell you,
she finds one a week. So I
gotta tell you, Nick, the
one.
Stuff that we have right now in our state is so completely nuts. It really makes California look like babies.
Tell them a little bit about what's going on in the great city of Albany.
Right now, we have for the first time in 10 million years, the Democrats took control of the state Senate. This was just so huge. They have a one-vote majority. And there's one guy there who's been under 2,000 investigations for various kinds of financial stuff. He flipped over to the other side, and then another guy followed him. The guy who followed him was at that point on trial for slashing his mistress with a piece of cut glass, and he's, now he's been only convicted of the misdemeanor because the mistress changed her mind and testified on his behalf. So now the state Senate has to decide whether they want to get rid of their one-vote majority and get rid of the slasher, who's not a slasher anymore, only a dragger through the halls on video camera guy, or not. And, we've got a huge deficit, which they're going to have to get to once they figure out what to do with the domestic abuser. And, that's just the...
And the last governor left after seeing
a
prostitute.
Of course,
the next governor is totally blind, and his first act in office was to announce what affairs he'd had.
Right. He wanted to get it out of the way. And Our comptroller is appointed because the comptroller was driven out of office after a scandal, and all of his people are under indictment now. And we do have an attorney general. He's there, and he's really there. He is so there. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. You cannot move without...
He's the only person left who can become the next governor. No one suggests that he won't become the next governor.
Well, Rudy Giuliani... seems to be sniffing around, yeah. So we'll have like two prosecutors fighting one another. That's anyway, so it's bad. It's very bad. Feel better about California. It could be worse, really. We've heard about California. We thought it was really bad for a while until the domestic abuser changed parties. And then we thought, God, this is worse.
Are there, going back to your column, are there things you can't say in the paper? Are there, do your bosses ever say, no, we won't publish that?
No, they never, ever, ever do. There are things you don't want to say. You particularly do not want to make fun of civilians, people who did not get in it. I mean, you just don't want to take some poor average person who happens to say something really stupid at some critical meeting and just beat them. Unless they bring a gun and the president's there, then it's okay. But normally, you want to be kind of careful not to, lose sight of the fact that there are people who have just did not buy into this world, and you just can't abuse them a lot. That's
what happens when important people call to complain. Does the governor call to yell at your boss and say, "How could you let Gail Collins write that?"
It's nice they never tell you. They usually do not tell you. I mean, one of the deals is, I don't know if you do that, but the deal is you're supposed to shield the writers so they don't know that you're getting all this pressure from one person or another.
We do that. That we do similarly.
You rewrite them, so you should be.
we rewrite them, but we let them take their own complaint calls. I don't know why he said such a stupid thing. Why don't you talk to him yourself, Governor? We only have a little time left before we do questions and answers, so let's take this little time and talk about the future of newspapers. The New York Times just announced this week that it was going to shed 100 more jobs from its newsroom. They did that last year also, and the New York Times has by far the largest newsroom in the country. The LA Times, the New York Times had about 1,350 employees a year ago. They now have about 1,250. They're going to lose another 100. The LA Times had about 1,200 employees at its peak 5 or 6 years ago. It now has about 600 employees. Every other employee has been lost one way or another. I don't know if the New York Times is going down the same road. Neither does Gale. We all hope not. But what do you? I mean, what do you think is? What do you think is going to happen next? Will the New York Times start to charge for its online content?
Well, we tried that once. You know, they charge for opinion for a while, and we made I think 10 million, 15 million a year doing it. But the feeling was that it was draining. Opinion really moves a lot of traffic, and that it was draining too much traffic from the rest of the website, and that was hurting ad revenues and stuff like that. It's very complicated. One of the things I was happiest about, I always knew I was not going to be editor for longer than 5 years, but I liked being editor. It was fun. The one part of it that I was just so thrilled about when I left was that I would never go to another meeting about our digital future. I mean, good Lord in heaven, we just talked about nothing. They're still doing it, and I'm sure your guys are too. The difference between our shop and Nick's shop is that, and I never thought I would say that because, you know, when I started out, I was living in New Haven. My husband was working for the New Haven Register, which was owned by a family forever. And they were all dimwits. I mean, my Lord, you thought there must have been inbreeding or something going on. They were so incredibly bad. And I always thought there was nothing worse than like a family that owns the paper. I didn't understand anything. I was so stupid. The only way you really survive right now, if there's a way to get through this, it's the papers who have families that have a sense of commitment. The Sulzberger family, I mean, their fortunes were totally wound up in this paper, and they get rid of their dividends. There were people living off these dividends. They cut their dividends down to nothing, and they've taken a huge, 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 huge hit on their assets. And I've never run into one of them that's attempted, that's sort of run around sort of muttering and saying, they're so supportive. They're just wildly, almost terrifyingly supportive of the paper. They're all sort of bred to believe that this is their sacred trust, and there's a lot of
difference. And they're proselytized to that. They're taken. Yeah. The Sulzberger family is taken on a retreat every year by the corporate people at the New York Times to instill in them this fervor about the paper, which they have. But I had a conversation with a member of the Sulzberger family about a year ago, and she was telling me that the difference between the Sulzbergers and the Chandlers was that the Chandlers had more children in the first generation. Mm. And because they had more children merely in the first generation, it meant that because both papers started around the same time. But by the time you got down to this generation, there are only, there are like 50 Sulzbergers who have to fight about this, but there were 300 or 400 Chandlers. And that means that the fortune is being, disseminated among many more people, and they're a lot more concerned about their money. The Sulzbergers are still mostly rich, although in this generation they're not so rich anymore as they were in the previous generation. And what happens is that as that happens, they have less and less commitment to the paper. They're not all working for the paper, and they have less and less feeling that they have to protect the paper at their own expense.
I don't think the Chandlers ever went through. I mean, it was Punch Sulzberger who invented all this stuff, but there's tons of things. Everybody who's a member of the family has that there's an organization, and they have meetings, and they go on retreats, and they go on holidays together, and just this sort of massive institutional attempt to keep everybody, including the youngest members, just completely invested in the thing. But it's scary to me that the only way you get to keep a newspaper going right now if there's a saintly family that's willing to give up their assets to support it. And certainly if it's a corporation, you're really screwed at this point in time. And I don't know. I mean, I presume that the future is going to be fine over the long run, but I don't think I'll live maybe to see the long run. So I'm kind of hoping that we hang on for a while.
So that brings me to my last question before we open it up, and that's, what's your plan B? It's famous that, everyone in the newspaper industry is secretly working on their plan B for when someone comes in and cuts their head off. What's yours? What are you going to do next?
Well, I have a lot of really good money-making plans out there. Laura Cartman is here tonight. She and I are working on an opera together. I want to go into the booming business of opera if I possibly can. And I'm writing what I expect to be a really big bestseller. It's a biography. This is a true fact, by the way. A biography of William Henry Harrison, the president who died after a month in office. So those are my two big plans, Nick.
Good luck to you. all right, let's open this up for questions. We have about 20 or 25 minutes, I think, to do this. So there are two people with microphones. Why don't we start with this woman in red right here.
Can we give a shout out to the microphone carriers? I always think, my God, they're well done, guys. They're unsung heroes, can I say? I know, my God.
She's a crowd pleaser.
Gail, as I said when you came in, I love you. I thank
you. I love
you,
too.
If the New York Times goes away, my life will be over as I know it. I used to pay for Time Select, and then they sent me my money back and said, we think you should get it for free. And I said, are you crazy? Anyway, that's my question is this. 1960, 2009, how have we done? Because I'm a little despairing over the state of women today. What is your opinion?
You know, there's the reason I loved writing this particular book was that there are endless problems, there are endless inequities to deal with. The big one to me, the big huge marker, is that we've got half the workforce is now female, and we have not still dealt with the question of who takes care of kids when everybody is working. That aside, especially if you go back, I mean, if you look at 1960, the bottom line attitude toward women's abilities and women's place in the world was not majorly different from the way it was in 1560 or 1060. From the beginning of recorded time, people had a certain idea about the limitations of the female sex. And it changed in my lifetime. And that the tiny sliver that I live in, it changed in. And that just knocks me out completely. And there are many horrible things and many inequalities. But that one fact is just so extraordinary to me. You know, in 1960, you couldn't do all those things. And it's all gone. And that there's a basic sense of fairness on the part of the public at large about what opportunities women should have. We got pants. we got tennis courts, and you know, kids aren't playing on the driveway anymore. We've got, it's really, really, really great story. And although we have to continue fighting for all the things that we need to continue fighting for, I think it's not bad once in a while to sit back and say, hot damn, you know, this is really cool, and I was there for it. That's me.
And that's certainly, I mean, you really get that sense reading the book, because this whole opening section, which talks about what life was like for women a mere 50 years ago, within my lifetime, it's quite stunning. Because although you know it all, it's when you read these things one after another, it's very impressive. Okay, before we get to the next question, there's something that I should have said at the very beginning. And when you opened your question by saying how much you love Gail and how you couldn't live without the New York Times, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, and I should be reiterating it. And that's it. None of you should be reading the New York Times. I was derelict in not making this clear. If you do read it, you may read it, in my opinion, as a second newspaper. I'm sorry?
How about reading both?
Reading both is acceptable. That's fine. In fact, reading both is great. Anyone who can read both is, which I do, is that's great. But I'm sorry. Next question. Right behind you. There's a guy.
I was just wondering, in light of everything that happened last year with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, how much of a factor do you think Hillary Clinton's gender played in that? And do you think it's easier at this point for a black man to be elected president than a woman?
A couple of things. Thank you for that question. I've thought about that a lot. There were some really irritating and discouraging things, of course, that went on during that campaign. You know, the nutcracker with, you know, the thighs, you know, the nutcracker thighs, the Hillary nutcracker and stuff. But Basically, I believe that 5% of the American population is completely out of its mind. So no matter what happens in the country, you are going to see some really appalling behavior on the edges of it. Beyond that, I think she lost the election because of a failure to organize well in the early caucus states, which is not really a big feminist thing. Beyond that, I thought it was so interesting when she started to win in Pennsylvania and Ohio toward the end, then everybody was asking, well, is this because people don't want an African-American, so they're turning to Hillary. And Susan Faludi wrote a piece for the op-ed page, which I thought was really smart, in which she said, what's happened here is that the problem for women candidates has always been that there's this sort of sense that they're parachuting in like the school monitor to clean things up and make people behave, and that guys always perceive that they're probably the ones that are going to be made to behave, and that there's kind of this resistance to it. And that when she got into those later states, I mean, the genius to me of Hillary Clinton is that she has made a record-breaking number of mistakes in her life. And every time she does, she figures out how to stand back after things that would have just flattened anybody else forever and how to fix it. And then she moves on. It's just amazing when you watch the trajectory of her career. She figured out how to fix that. And at the end, she was running a stupendous campaign in which she really did feel like she was right there in the ditch with the guys and the women and the struggling people of Pennsylvania, Ohio. And she figured out how to run a presidential campaign. It was too late for her. But it's obvious to me that women will be running from now on, and that the country now thinks of it as a pretty normal thing. And that's just huge. If that's all the last of her legacy, she'll have done just something extraordinary, I think.
Person back there. I'm sorry.
Right. No, I was going to, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
You answered the questions. I picked the questions. Didn't we talk about this?
Can you just talk a little bit about what you think the real influence is of organizations such as the White House Project and Emily's List?
Thanks. Who was asking the question? I'm sorry, I couldn't. Oh, there you are. I'm sorry. Thank you. I think it's very useful. Women start, and all the White House Project, Emily's List, all these things sort of help, you know, support women candidates. Women almost always traditionally started out later in politics than men do. And I think that's another one of these tensions, family tension things, because often women wait till their kids are older. I mean, you would have to be a maniac to try to run a political campaign unless you had somebody, some supportive spouse at home taking care of the kids and stuff, if you happen to have kids of that age. And some of the women do, but it's harder. And in a lot of states, like not so much in the West, but in states like my state in New York, the politics is so ossified, the interests have been there for so long, it's so hard to break through that any new group coming in just has a terrible time. So I think it's anything you can do to kind of get some support on the bottom is really a good thing. We've still got less than 20% in the House and Senate. There's a long way to go.
Gail's friend.
People in the corners sometimes need
right.
a little.
You're right.
Thank you. In 1974, I left university and I started at a traditional firm of accountants in the City of London. And I was one of the first wave of female employees who wasn't a secretary. And there were a lot of issues that needed to be dealt with, but the most difficult one was sexual harassment, which came in many different forms. And I just wonder whether you had addressed that in your book or thought about it, because to me, I think that's one of the most important things that female employees don't have to deal with now, which they would have had to deal with in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of younger women, when they talk about madmen, that's the part of it that really strikes them the most, just this idea that guys could just run around and, you know, grab at you and stuff. In the United States, I think, you know, that the Anita Hill thing, and Clarence Thomas, it was kind of a weird political trajectory, but the thing that happened after that, came out of that, was this national conversation that went on everywhere. It certainly went on in newsrooms. You know, newsrooms were one of the places that were absolutely sure, the editors were sure that it was not possible to have a decent newsroom if you couldn't, you know, run around making smarmy jokes and, you know, just being relaxed in the way you could be relaxed if you just didn't care whose feelings you hurt or what you did. And amazingly, they discovered rather quickly, after like one or two suits were filed, that you could do it really easily. It worked out great. It was no problem at all. It's a huge thing, and that's the glory of a lawsuit. You know, so many things. Just a few lawsuits just really go a long way.
How about this woman here?
How far do you think we are with women in the military, and what needs to be done, or is it all done? It's all done. It's
not,
all good.
Yeah, it's not all done. It's amazing how fast it did happen. I found it so interesting going back and looking at like the Equal Rights Amendment fight. You know, one of the big problems for the supporters of the Equal Rights Amendment was that there was this thought, there was an agreement, in fact, that if a draft came back, women would be drafted. And the idea of a woman in combat, of a woman being killed in combat, was presented as this ungodly thing that could never be accepted in such a country as ours. And we've lost almost 200 women in combat in the Gulf War and the following.
That's a great step forward. Sorry.
Thank you. And so, there are a huge part of the military now, and there's still these rules about you can't have combat-related jobs, which is problematic because so many of the jobs that you get promoted for are combat-related jobs. But because of what's happened in the Gulf, it's much less so. The one thing that the opponents of women being integrated in the military in a big way said that turns out to be right is that sexual harassment is a huge, huge problem. And I know the military is now at least aware of it and working on it, but that's still, they've got a long way to go on that. But incredible women, just really all over the place now in the military, and it's really just knocks me out to see them sometimes.
Thank you. Again, I guess on the same vein of possibly not the best way to go with equality, and I see it a lot in the high school that I teach at, is the increase of women and violent crime and aggression. I just was wondering what your opinion was.
Women that committing violent crimes.
Mm-hmm. And increasingly aggressive behavior.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a problem of, I tend to think, and you could educate me on this, We had this discussion on a program I was on the other day. Which problems are problems of race? Which problems are problems of sex? And which problems are problems of class? And so many of the things that we define as a problem, say, of sex, seem to me to be more problems of class, that there are just so many kids who are caught in a culture that they can't get out of, that they're being, you know, that their parents are stuck in, and all those things kind of feed into it, and that's sort of it seems to me that where that comes in, too. I don't have any really smart answers. I worry a lot about violence against women, and it really bothers me that younger people don't seem to feel as disturbed about that as older people do. And I would love to figure out some way to do something about that. As to the other, I'm not sure.
But it's a big issue on campus, right?
What, violence against women?
Yeah, students are concerned about it.
It's a big issue on college campuses. It's not a big issue in high schools. It's not a big issue on non-campus cultures out there. I mean, it really bothers me that you can be a popular singer and you can beat up your girlfriend and you can come back the next day and be on stage and nobody attempts to tear you off the stage and beat your little face into a bloody pulp. That would be violence too, though, I guess.
You can be majority leader of the New York State Senate. Cut your girlfriend's
That's
face.
That's it, yes, exactly. We've got them there. And, you know, there's a lot of tension there right now in the Senate between the men and the women on this issue.
Yeah. Okay, this guy. I think. think I'm forgetting the people on the back.
I guess this is a question for both. I'm just curious if you had thoughts about neither one of your papers nor most major newspapers in the country ever published the cartoon of the Danish Muhammad, and it offended everyone. To me, that was censorship through and through, and I just wondered what you had thoughts about that.
Well, it was my decision. I mean, when I was the op-ed editor at the LA Times and the cartoons came out, there were people who thought that in solidarity we should immediately publish all these exact same cartoons that were having people, nearly killed in Europe. And we seriously thought about it, and I believe that we ran, in one case, we did run them in the news stories. We ran a couple of them in the news pages to show people, along with the news stories, what these cartoons were so they could make judgments about themselves. But we decided not to do it on the op-ed page on the grounds that, you know, while I completely agree that a newspaper ought to have the right to publish those cartoons if it wants to, that there was no... I didn't see what would be gained by us publishing terribly offensive cartoons that are terribly offensive to certain people, and which we probably wouldn't have run in the first place because of their offensiveness. I didn't see what was to be gained by publishing them, though I 100% stand behind the right of the Danish paper to do so and not to be, you know, hacked to pieces in retaliation.
I wasn't editor then, and I don't remember if I ever knew what the arguments were, but the Times does not run cartoons. The Times, it's famous for not running cartoons ever. We've never had a political cartoonist. And when I was the editor, there was a lot of discussion about maybe we should get some more kind of illustrative, political illustrators and things. And I found it's hard. I'm not into it. It's very hard for a thing that's oriented toward print to figure out how to do the picture stuff in a way that makes sense, that's sophisticated and sensitive, while also being out there. And I never went there before this was ever an issue. It just like eats up the whole page. If you've got a really stark cartoon, the rest of the paper might as well go home, because all people will focus on is that. And I do find that illustrators, it's hard to find a really politically sophisticated illustrator. The illustrators tend to want to do things that are really, 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 really stark. You know, George Bush with fangs came up quite a bit during his administration. And it's not a good answer, but it's something we struggled with a lot. And at least when I was editor, I resolved by not doing pictures, which is not the best answer in the world, but that's where I was.
How about the guy behind you?
I guess this is kind of just sort of a comment on the first question that was asked. And this is, I'm somewhat of a younger guy, and I just want to, when I hear about these things about women not being able to wear pants and so on, I mean, my head spins with how silly that sounds. So as far as what kind of progress has been made, I'd just like to point out that for like a younger generation, there's this element of these problems that were happening just in 1960, and where we've come today is, all of it just sounds silly to me. And, the fact that I don't even think it's, you would consider, like, why would it matter if a woman's wearing pants? And I feel like most people my age would feel the same way. I feel like that is progress in itself.
Yeah, and can I say that this is, I always forget to say this, this is not just a story about women. This was a journey that guys were on at the same time. Nora Ephron told me, and it's in the book actually, I think, that she really felt sorry for guys who got married in 1960 under the old rules, because suddenly they're like, what did I do, You come home one night and your wife's having a consciousness-raising group in the living room about husband's failure to give the proper kind of orgasms. I mean, it's like very traumatic. And it's just everything, right now, most young people marry and look at the future of their lives in terms of not only a personal partnership with their mates, but an economic partnership that both people are expected to contribute to. I know when we were... about a year or two ago, I think, one of our reporters wrote a story, which we heard for forever, about Yale students, women at Yale who were not going to, said they didn't want to get, you know, have careers, that as soon as they had children, they wanted to retire and be homemakers, which triggered, I think we're still getting letters about it to this day. But, you know, we had an editorial board meeting, we were trying to think of some, you know, great feminist response to all this. And the youngest guy on the board, Nick Kulish, who was about 30 then, volunteered to write something. And he wrote this piece, it was a signed piece, saying, "Women of Yale, on behalf of the men, have we been consulted about this? Because I would have made a lot different life choices if I thought you guys weren't prepared to go and, you know, work with us, because I don't know how the hell I'm going to support the family if you decide to do this." And I think that's very telling. I mean, really, this is, it's not like everybody's sitting down and making these principled decisions about what wives should do. It's just, this is what the way the world is. But I think it really is a story. In fact, I thought, can I tell one more story? This is Steve Weissman, who Nick knows, I think, was an editorial board member with me, and his wife is Elizabeth Buemiller, who used to be the Times White House correspondent and still works for the Times. And they had, when they were in New York, young children. And Elizabeth got picked to go and cover the war on Kosovo for a while. And I ran into Steve one day, and he looked like a dead man. And I said, "What is wrong with you?" And he said with great pain and misery, "My wife's in Albania and the hamster's missing." And I always thought maybe my next book would be about guys over the last 50 years, and I'd call it "My Wife's in Albania and the Hamster's Missing," but that's not it.
All right, we have time for, I think, one or two more questions. How about the woman in the back there?
This year, there have been a few news stories talking about women and their happiness. And the argument has been, gee, if you look compared to 40 years ago, women are actually more likely to say that they're unhappy. And isn't this ironic after the women's movement, and how come they're not happier now? And Time magazine had a cover story about this, and the Huffington Post as well. And there have been some good critiques of the studies, including one by Barbara Ehrenreich in the LA Times. But I'm curious to know what your reaction, if you're familiar with these studies, and to what extent you think this is legitimately true, and how you'd respond.
You know how sometimes you read something and it stays with you forever somewhere in the back of your mind? When they came out, I was remembering instantly this a column that it was like in the 1970s, late 1970s, by Ellen Goodman from the Boston Globe. And what she said, "It's so strange. All the men I know are miserable and all the women I know are so happy. And I thought about it a lot, and the reason is that all the men I knew grew up thinking they were going to be president of the United States. And now they're just teaching college. And all the women I knew grew up thinking they were going to be maybe a part-time receptionist. And now they're all teaching college." So they're really happy, and the men are really not. And this whole thing reminds me of that. I don't think that women are miserable or, you know, filled with, you know, suicidal thoughts. I think they feel harassed. They're stretched out time-wise, and they have great expectations for themselves that they're not always going to meet. And all those things are the troubling things that make for the richness of life. I've seen a lot of studies that say that women who have children report being less happy. Now, obviously, I am absolutely sure that's not because they don't want to have their children or they're unhappy having children. It's because they're running around so much all the time, and they feel really stressed. But, you know, I accept the interestingness of these arguments, but I do not take them the same way I think that Ariana and some of the other people have.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just one last question.
There's somebody. I'm sorry.
How about that? God, I totally ignored that side of the room. I really apologize. I didn't know there wasn't that side of the room.
Just when I was ready to give up.
I'm sorry.
My husband and I are huge fans of yours, Gail. And
you sent me a card. Thank you so much.
Yes, okay. And
how do you know based on what she just said?
I recognize him. Excuse me. Go on. Never mind.
And our favorite column was one that you did that was entitled "Ken Doll in Lust" regarding John Edwards. Mm. And you had a line there that was so priceless. I will never forget it as long as I live. You were describing him, and the line was, "In the annals of weaseldom." How did you come up with that line?
I don't really know, but I do love it when people quote me like that. It's just so thank you very much. That's not...
I'm going to... Louise is looking at me, but I'm going to take one more question from over here. Yes, you.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about this idea of a third wave feminism. As a young feminist who works in a feminist office with a lot of older women, I know it's sort of a point of contention sometimes. This idea that women are, you know, sort of always fighting the same fight, or whether or not there is a change and an idea of a third wave or not.
I think there is. I mean, the young feminists that I know and that I read, you know, I don't think a different world perception about what, you know, would be good things and bad things to happen, but sort of different levels of concern. And there's a lot of fighting about sort of sex stuff in particular, that, you know, worrying about hooking up is not a productive thing to do, but it is important to worry about sexual violence, for instance. I mean, and there's always been this interesting tension. Older women who were in the movement or whatever always feel like they're underappreciated by younger women, and that younger women sometimes don't know what they've been through, don't appreciate the horrible things that happened in 1960 and all that. I find it, the idea, although it does hurt our feelings, yes, but the idea that young women today come into the world just absolutely sure that they are going to be able to do the things that they set out to do, and that they aren't going to be constrained by their gender and have different issues that they're working on, that just knocks me out. I think that's absolutely fantastic and stupendous, and it's just something to celebrate. Although, if you would like to read a history book about what happened before, I'm sure that would even be better for, you know, the whole thing. But.
So that allows me to say that the book is going to be for sale. out in the front there, Gail is going to be signing books. We're really glad that you came. The Allowed series is a really terrific series. I don't know how many of you have been to things here before. You are also welcome, when you go out on your way to buy your book, you're welcome also to stop and put a donation in the donation jar, or give a check, or just thank Louise for organizing all these great talks. And again, we thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Allowed Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Allowed theme composed by Larry Karish.